Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, making the spanking new ancient city that will greet the Olympics in Beijing meant a lot of old had to go. In a handful of years, China's capital city has been transformed, a prime bulldozer target, Beijing's famed hutongs. The maze-like alleyways, communal courtyards, and jam-packed old neighborhoods that have housed Beijingers since the time of Kublai Khan. American Michael Meyer settled into a hutong as the old neighborhoods and their unique ways and culture were coming down. This hour on Point, his experience and the last days of old Beijing. Joining me now from Beijing is Michael Meyer, author of The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Backstreets of a City Transformed. Meyer has traveled, worked, and lived in China for most of the last 13 years as a Peace Corps volunteer, a teacher, and a writer. For two of those most recent years, he lived in a hutong in Beijing called Dajialam. Michael Meyer, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We know, having dipped into your book, that it's really all about the culture and the people, but help us visualize first these neighborhoods you're talking about physically and physically what they're giving way to. Then we'll turn to what's lived inside them.
Sure. If listeners can picture Venice and its canals, the hutong are to Beijing what Venice's canals are to that city. They're quite narrow, often only maybe 8 yards across. The architecture is built on a one-to-one ratio, meaning that as wide as the street is as tall as the houses are. The houses are joined together as well, and so when you walk down them, you have this feeling of being nestled in a little village, really, at the heart of the city. And since 1991, those lanes have been bulldozed, and what we're seeing now in Beijing is that new Beijing is bigger, wider, flatter, more. Eight-lane roads, bicycles pushed off the roads, cars coming in, and then high-rise buildings with huge setbacks from the street, and they're not conjoined. So, in fact, they look more like pieces of individual sculpture rather than these really dense networks that you find in the hutong.
And you really can't imagine a more dramatic shift from one to the other. I mean, way back in the starting in maybe the 80s, I spent time in those Beijing hutong in one very near Tiananmen Square where the families lived kind of on top of one another. We had a wonderful dinner, I remember, there. And it required sort of pulling chairs and tables out from here and there and kitchens all over, contributing into a central courtyard for the dinner. And it looked like many generations and many families interwoven. I'm reading here that the word itself is so old, it comes from the Mongolian word for path between tents, just to get a sense of this going back to kind of Genghis Khan time.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And once you moved into that kind of neighborhood, what did you find?
I moved in. I'd lived in Beijing starting in 1997, and I consider the city my home. I met my wife here. But by 2005, I started connecting these dots, as it were, of rubble around the city because I would show up to a favorite restaurant and it would be gone, or I'd return to a neighborhood I enjoyed strolling in and it would be gone. And I started getting a more bird's eye view of things and thinking like, wow, there's a pattern here and no one's telling the story. I might as well have lived in Cleveland because I was in a high-rise apartment that didn't have a lot of characteristics of old Beijing. So in 2005, I moved to Dajialam, which is Beijing's oldest neighborhood, which is just south of Tiananmen Square. And I moved in 2005 because I wanted to experience this vanishing way of life, which, as you just said, is incredibly dense. And you are on top of one another, and everybody is overlaid on top of one another. And there's some detriments to that, too, as you can imagine. The first day I moved in, the 80-year-old, who I call the widow in the book, fixed her eyes on mine, and she said, "Public is public. Private is private." And then for the next 2 years, she proceeded to break that rule by waking me up every morning at 7 to give me dumplings for breakfast or to hector me about not wearing enough clothes or whatnot.
Take us deeper into that. You describe this culture in these neighborhoods that have been there for so many, in some ways, centuries, as central to the traditional urban culture of Beijing. Give us a sense of the interweavings that make up that culture and the face that it produces.
One thing that I was surprised to find in the lanes is that the social network in Beijing, or the traditional social network, is modeled on the exact same pattern as the lanes themselves, that are, it's horizontal, it's not vertical. If you want to find a job, or you're looking for a mate or whatnot, or a new car or whatever you want, you don't go to the yellow pages. Maybe you don't use the internet as much as you would somewhere else. In fact, you go side to side. You ask somebody and they pass you on to a friend of a friend. And that's the way it works. And I'm always amazed every morning the widow would wake me up at 7, and we had six families living in this one courtyard. And from 7 o'clock until noon, I was never alone because, excuse me, if I stepped out of the lane, I was face-to-face with the recycler who was out buying bottles, or I was face-to-face with Auntie Yang who was out walking her niece. I met my students on the way to school. There'd be people selling wares, you know, with things spread out on blankets. And all that started changing over the first year. I mean, my students and I used to lean out the window of the school where I volunteered, and I would say, can you name that building? And I would point at the Great Hall of the People, the China's Parliament, and they would say, no, we don't know what that is. And
get
I would
out
point
of
at
here.
The front, or I'd point at the front gate, which is on the edge of Tiananmen Square, and they'd say, we don't know what that is. But when I pointed to the golden arches on the edge of our neighborhood, the kids all shouted, McDonald's. And by the end of that school year, we could see a Walmart, too.
You were really close to Tiananmen and the center of things then. I mean, you said that to understand the dynamic of this, you have to understand that Beijing in some ways is not like so many other great contemporary cities. It's just got a fundamentally different history, and until all these started coming down, sort of different guts.
Yes, very much so. I mean, it's very difficult to compare any city to another because cities are products of their history and their politics and their geography and whatnot. But Beijing, this was the characteristic of what we think of as Beijing. And it was these neighborhoods are places where starting in 1956, when the government took private housing stock and subsidized it, they said that land and housing would no longer be a commodity, but it would be a basic right. And rents were subsidized to cost about the price of a pack of cigarettes. So starting in 1956, you had all sorts of different people being assigned into these courtyard homes. And that's why it's possible, like where I live, to have me, a volunteer teacher, the widow, who's 80 years old and has raised two grandchildren in 65 square feet. And then you have the Hans, who are also characters in the book, who are migrants from China's northeast who have come here to find work. So it's just this huge interplay of generations and geography that goes on in these lanes.
And coming into what you've called the last of the great old cities of the planet to modernize. Mm. I mean, a city here that wasn't bombed in World War II, that wasn't really razed to the ground, at least until now, to make way for modernity.
Yeah, and it survived Japanese occupation, and it survived earthquakes. And now what's bringing it down isn't these external forces, but actually the real estate market is what's really bringing it down.
How great is the transformation of Beijing just in the time that you've been coming in and out of China and living there? Give us a sense of just how radical, how sweeping the changes in this city have been.
In China as a whole, I'm just amazed at how rapidly the countryside is starting to urbanize. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in southwest China in Sichuan province, and I was there in 1995. And when I go back to my former Peace Corps town, I feel like an old man. It's been 13 years, but a generation is a lifetime here. I mean, the first thing I see now when I go back is wide highways, new bridges, better infrastructure, a 24-hour McDonald's and whatnot. And it's the same with Beijing. When I first moved here in 1997, I remember when the first Starbucks opened, and I remember thinking, oh, this will never catch on. It's coffee. And that was in 1998. Now there's 60 Starbucks plus in the city. There's 150 McDonald's and KFCs and these sort of products too. But beyond that, beyond those Western things, the city has just completely remade itself. And the Olympics has been a proponent for that. It's been a good thing, actually. We're getting better subways here and better public transport. And to finish on that with the change is that I live in a courtyard home that's 100 years old. I have a cold water tap and I use the public toilet, but I can surf the internet. The phone company actually strung a broadband internet line over my tiled rooftop and into my courtyard. So we can get online at my house. We just can't use the bathroom.
But the thing that's striking me here, and I should say, you can see wonderful photos of Beijing's Hutongs at our website and read an excerpt of a Michael Myers book, onpointradio.org. But the images coming out of these, just mile after mile of these tall, proud apartment buildings, never mind the super sophisticated, hyper-modern architecture of the Olympics, of the new CCTV broadcasting office tower that's gone up. I mean, it just, it looks like a city I don't recognize from only a few years ago.
Yeah, the transformation is really, you know, Hutong, these little lanes, were often named for the product that was manufactured there. So you could have Honey Bee Lane, you know, if people made honey there. You'd have Pineapple Lane if people sold pineapple. I live on Red Bayberry and Bamboo Slanted Street, which is a street in the book, because Red Bayberry, an apothecary, sold a traditional herb there. What I'm saying is, at one point, Beijing had these 7,000 lanes inside the old city. Now, the old city was 25 square miles, so it's about the size of Manhattan. So again, 25 square miles, 7,000 lanes, all little separate villages named for the products they manufactured often. Now Beijing, the municipality of Beijing, is the size of Connecticut. The number of lanes has shrunk drastically down to maybe 1,500. And it's just a transformation from a village to a global capital. Because you have, people probably are familiar with these photographs and stuff. Beijing in the 21st century is positioning itself to be a very different kind of city.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the vanishing back streets of Beijing and the culture that has gone with them. My guest is Michael Meyer. He's author of the new book, The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Back Streets of a City Transformed. Behind me, you can hear some video we found on YouTube of someone's journey through a Beijing Hutong. Michael Meyer joins us from Beijing. We've got callers right now from Chesapeake, Virginia. Jackson's calling. Jackson, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, the people of Beijing in a city that is so ancient, why would they be so quick to embrace modernization in that way?
Michael Meyer, big, broad question, but they're in the middle of it. What do you say?
That's a great question. Thanks for calling, Jackson. I think it's because it's overdue, frankly. Beijing kind of missed out. Well, it didn't kind of. It did miss out on modernizations that took place in New York City in the 1920s, in Paris in the 1860s, London before that. I once talked to an architect here, and I said, you know, you don't have to make all the same mistakes that Americans have. And he looked at me and said, we have every right to make the same mistakes that Americans have. And I thought there's a lot of truth in that, that people do want a modern lifestyle. I don't think they want to live like Americans do, mind you. They want to live like Chinese, just with modern implements around them.
So are Beijingers feeling, are they mourning when these neighborhoods go away, or just who cares, off we go, no problem?
Yes and no. I was very surprised in the course of researching the book. I thought when I moved in that people would very be much attached to their home and they would consider it heritage. And found in turn, I actually found they were more attached to their community because these networks of lanes are so dense that really an urban planner once said to me, everything you need except for maybe open heart surgery is within 15-minute walk of your home. It's very, very convenient. But people do want to have modern apartments. And there's a saying here in Beijing that goes, pan chai, pa chai, which means look forward to destruction, but also fear destruction. People were excited at the idea that maybe they could get a new apartment. But then they were often more upset at the lack of transparency in the eviction process or about the sort of compensation they would receive.
You're right about the big white character, destroy, knock down, raise that gets painted on the side of these, and it doesn't take much time at all for them to be gone once that big Chinese character is daubed on the wall.
You really can't fight City Hall here in Beijing.
Get a call from,
I think that's true of cities anywhere.
Well, maybe not quite equally, though.
Yeah.
The big steamroller has been very big there on the way to these Olympics. Let's go to Nicholas in Acton, Massachusetts. Nicholas, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been in Beijing for the past 3 summers, and I've noticed all of the building and talking buildings that you're talking about. But the question I have is, what happens to the social structures and the families of the Hutong who were displaced. It doesn't seem like they could just go into a high-rise and be the same. I'll take my answer off air.
Thanks, Nicholas. The government says maybe 500,000. You say maybe a million and a half, maybe more, Michael Meyer. What happens to all those people?
Thanks for your question, Nicholas. It's changed. From 1991 until 2001, you were assigned a new apartment in the suburbs. In 2001, the policy was changed, so you actually got a cash settlement based on how many square meters your house is. The thing that people get upset about is that let's say maybe they'll give you it starts at $1,000 a square meter here, but the land value inside the city center is $3,000 to $4,000 a square meter. So when you get this settlement, you often can't afford to move back into your community, and people are very upset about that. And they don't move en masse. In other words, because I live on Red Bayberry and Bamboo Slanted Street doesn't mean that we'll just move our community, you know, just 20 miles outside of town. Instead, people decide where they want to move to, and they choose the apartments they want to buy. And so naturally, the neighborhood becomes fractured. And the thing is, though, about human beings and cities, and I see this in China all the time, though, is that life coalesces around architecture. Architecture is just the shell. And so I'm very interested to see, say, 5 or 6 years on, when people live in these new communities, if in fact they will start, you know, a new pattern of life. They will know who their teachers are, who their doctor is, or who the person is that sells in their newspaper, and they'll start replicating what used to be in the Hutong. I think it'll be difficult, though, just because the Hutong is so condensed. Dajialan, the neighborhood I'm talking about, it's a half square mile. That's as big as Vatican City. Vatican City has 500 people in a half square mile. Dajialan has 57,000 people. And so that density, of course, brings with it its own social structure, and you don't have that in the high-rises.
I have to say, in the book, you seem pretty skeptical about what happens when they go to the high-rises, from the sense of dense interconnectedness to a kind of anemy, a kind of floating life that's disconnected from all that weave.
That's true. And I'm like I said, I'm curious to see 5, 10 years on. The people in the book that I follow several characters. I mean, the book is all character-based anyway. But some of the people that have moved out to the high-rises, so far in the last year or two, they've been very morose about the move and missing their sort of, you know, their circle of friends that was around them. But the younger people actually like it a great deal. My co-teacher in the book wanted nothing more than to have a child, and there was no way she was going to have a baby in a house without central heating or an indoor toilet, you know. So since she's moved out to the suburbs, she's actually happier than she was in the lane that she grew up in as a girl.
Let's take a call from Mount Shasta, California. Gary, you're on the air with Michael Meyer.
Hello, Tom. How you doing?
Very well. What do you know, Gary?
I'm doing fine. I was just curious, did they have anything like a National Historical Society? Did they evaluate any of the old buildings, or did they just raise everything to the ground?
Great question. Michael Meyer?
Hi, Gary. There are cultural protection bureaus here. It's difficult, though, because the land is still owned by the state. So a lot of these parcels of land that these neighborhoods stand on were transferred to developers in the 1990s. And they have the right, after they got required the land rights, that they can raise the structures and put up new buildings. So even if a cultural heritage protection bureau will certify something as being historic, they are often powerless against these companies. There's an activist here named Hua Xinmin, and she will go around and yell at people tearing down houses and say, this is protected, this is protected, you can't do this. And she'll phone the police. And she said, my work, I feel like a fireman. I go around the city, but instead of a hose putting out fires, I try to chase people off buildings that are slated for destruction.
Michael Meyer's with us from Beijing. He's the author of the new book, The Last Days of Old Beijing. We're joined right now as well from China's capital by Mr. Li Hu. He's a partner in the New York-based firm Stephen Hall Architects. He and the firm have designed a big residential project called Linked Hybrid, one of the many big residential projects now going up on the Beijing skyline. It's a complex of luxury, mixed-use high-rises with parks built on skyways between buildings, upper floors, cinemas, shops, schools, you name it, a real big project here, the kind of thing that has around the city replaced Hutong. Mr. Li, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So you are creating Beijing's future. Do you have any nostalgia for its past? Are you sorry to see the Hutong going away, or happy to see the high-rises go up with all the bridges and parks and schools and you name it?
Well, We actually, what we did didn't replace any hutongs. It was built on a factory site. Because back in the Mao's time, he has planned many, many factories inside the inner part of the city. What's interesting, if you see today, many large-scale urban projects are built on previous factory site where all these factories have moved out of the city. So we're doing one of those. You know, of course, almost everyone would say they're sad with Hutong being erased. Unfortunately, the city realized the real problem of that, and a few years ago, could be maybe 10 years ago, they formally legalized the protection of a few remaining areas. So we are quite proud to be involved in this project, and in a way, I think we challenging and trying to put in a new potential model for a high-rise residential neighborhood, which is a mixed use, and it's open. This is quite the opposite of most the modern apartment complexes that are being built in China.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right here at a photograph, and it really, you can see the effort to have interlocking lives here, bridges between these apartment towers and public spaces and so on, the kind of open city idea that you describe. But as you say, in some ways, it's an exception. Lots and lots of towers have gone up without this. What do you think, Li Hu, about Beijing's culture? I mean, you're a serious architect. You know, of course, that our built environment affects the way we live, the way we interact, the way we see the world. Do you see Beijing's fundamental culture changing with this fundamental physical change that's come to the Chinese capital?
Absolutely. You know, coming from, let's say, before the 70s or 80s, most people lived in the inner city. In those hutong, you know, the hutong, again, is different from the hutong from 100 years ago, where the hutong after the socialist countries become multifamily courtyard houses. And then that started changed to when the new wave of development started coming in, the most, let's say, going after model will be a gated community, unfortunately. And that's been going on for decades and still going on today, where people think gated community would be a more luxurious model for high-end housing. And then people started to move out of the city, going to suburban houses. And what's interesting to see in the last few years, 3 or 4 years, people start to move back to the city and people start to be open to the idea to have an open community where, you know, the mixed use, people start to accept the idea of mixed use and start to realize the conveniency of having a mixed use complex to live in. So when we started the Link Hybrid, when we first brought in this idea to do, first, it's open community, and secondly, it's mixed use. That wasn't easily accepted. In fact, was silently accepted, and we had to fight for this idea to make it survive. But fortunately, as the building is closing to be finished, people just love it, and you know it's being sold very well on the market.
Michael Meyer, I don't know if you've seen Li Hu's development. I'm looking at it here. It really is kind of a wildly interwoven, but absolutely brand new. Place. Do you see this as a great exception in Beijing? I mean, what's happening to most people who move into either gated communities or those phalanxes of relative high rises when they move out of the Hutong?
It is. This project is a great exception because, as Li Hu was saying, when you look at suburban Beijing, these developments aren't mixed use. And even though they have names that evoke America, like New Yorker or Park Avenue or Napa Valley or Dating Bright California, they don't resemble American suburbs or communities in the least. There isn't a public library. There isn't a church or temple. There isn't a park that you can actually use and run on the grass. You know, these services that we take for granted in the States, there isn't a lot of shopping that you can walk to because that maybe is seen as unsightly in these communities, and they don't want that. So I think what Li Hu's doing and this project that's coming into Beijing is fantastic. It's the kind of housing I'd like to see more and more of here.
Let's take a call from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Chris, you're on the air with Michael Meyer and Li Hu.
Hello. I'd like to ask the author a question about modernity. Like him, I spent time in Beijing and first went there in 1997. I studied at Beida for a couple of years after mm-hmm. that and also taught at a university. Now, my Chinese friends in the last few years have been caught up in something called the Guo Xue Ruo, which is sort of a national studies trend or movement. There are a number of television programs and authors who are very popular, and they deal with sort of recovering something that Chinese feel they've lost in their culture, whether it's in the Analects of Confucius or whether it's an appreciation of the Three Kingdoms, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if people in Beijing are now coming to appreciate what they're losing when all of these futons are destroyed in the way that they're beginning to appreciate what they've lost culturally, as in the case of authors like Yudan and Zhongqin.
Chris, it's a wonderful question. Let me put it to Li Hu first because we've only got him for a couple more minutes. Mr. Li, in Beijing, what yes. about it? A new movement of appreciation for traditional Chinese culture? Can you have that and lose the architecture in which that culture flourished? Are they contradictory?
I certainly don't think there's any contradictory on it. But the greatest challenge for architects is that the difference from the Western history. The Chinese traditional traditions in architecture cannot be adopted physically easily. Because I think that the spirit of the Chinese traditional architecture is in the space, in the sensitivity of materials, in the lightings, and the openness of the plants, and the flexibility of the plants. Many things that are more cultural, more up to philosophical rather than physical. It's not you can take a physical form and simplify that easily. So I think it's certainly more challenging for architects to trying to do something directly related to tradition. But however, I think what's interesting and I think the right challenge for the architects is to create the spaces that's going to formulate that and help to affect and influence people's life, which is a totally new future of urban living, you know. And for the project, a few projects, Stephen Hall and I have been working together for the last 5 years in China, and three very large urban scale projects. We've been struggling to fight for the public spaces, which we think is probably the most important thing in urbanity, and where unfortunately at the moment the government is not really putting enough effort on building public spaces.
May I ask you, Mr. Li, let me ask you, Mr. Li, if I may, I've just got you for half a minute more, and we'll go to Michael Meyer after a break, but do you think that Michael romanticizes the old Beijing, the Hutong, the old architecture?
Well, I don't think he romanticized the old Hutong, but I do think quite many people romanticized the life in Hutong. Where, you know, the Hutong, I think there's a period that the traditional Hutong living, courtyard living, is where it's a single family unit. So that's a very beautiful comfort living. Now, after the new China, after 49, where the land is reformulated, where people start to share the Hutong, and the life is becoming somehow miserable, I think, inside Hutong. If people have ever have actually visited those spaces and experience those life inside, it's not as it's certainly not comfortable. There's no sense of privacy.
Li Hu in Beijing, I know we have to let you go. We're very grateful to you for being with us from Stephen Hall Architects. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the vanishing back streets of Beijing and the culture that goes with them. My guest is Michael Meyer. He's author of The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Back Streets of a City Transformed. He joins us from Beijing. Michael Meyer, we just had Li Hu for a few minutes there, but it was so good to have him just to get the perspective of a Chinese architect at work on this right now, and I wanted to get your response as well to the caller, our wonderful caller from Minneapolis, saying, how does this architectural change, this change of the venue of life, relate to what we saw recently in Shanghai as well, which is a marked stirring interest in traditional Chinese culture, even at the same time the country's modernizing?
Tom, I want to speak back one point prior to this about romanticizing life in the Hutong. Let me assure listeners that throughout the book, any romantic notions I have about living in one of these neighborhoods is completely eroded by using the public latrine every morning, by using the bathhouse to shower, by having the police around me all the time, keeping an eye on me and whatnot.
There may be romance there, but not exactly romanticizing. Okay.
Yeah, there was a time when I hit the my low point was I started going to Walmart and wandering the aisles just for the air conditioning. And I found that a lot of my neighbors were doing the same thing. No one was buying anything. We were just inside, you know.
Right.
To speak back to the idea of traditional culture, I have seen it because I volunteered at elementary school in the book, and I also volunteer at the neighborhood committee, which is the local government office to teach elderly people. And there was a very big shift from 2005 as the Olympics gained more momentum toward valuing the neighborhood. I mean, the school lessons were tailored to so kids would learn the history of this particular neighborhood, the history of Beijing. When the elderly wanted to learn English, it was based on discussing the history of their neighborhood. And that was a real big change because prior to that, everything was just, you know, based on the Olympics. And I saw the Olympic movement actually starting to have an effect on consciousness of traditional culture.
Mm. Let's get a call from Joe in Wickford, Rhode Island. Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, actually, you've basically made my point. A friend of mine is an architect in China who's done a great deal of work in Beijing. And we were talking about some development work he was doing in one of the neighborhoods near Tiananmen Square. Mm-hmm. And I looked at him in horror. I said, well, what is happening to these communities where relationships between neighbors go back generations? And I was very much reprimanded for my comment. He told me that, you know, Westerners look at these neighborhoods with a certain romantic eye, and they don't realize how difficult life was. Mm-hmm. And many of these people are not looking back.
I mean, of course, he has an interest in the development, though, at the same time, Joe, right? He, like a lot of other people, is making a bundle on the transformation.
Well, as an architect, believe me,
okay, a packet.
He wasn't making as much as you might think. Now, the developer, maybe so, but he's a very sensitive person,
yeah.
Highly educated, and I'm prepared to hear his words.
No, we get it. Joe, thank you very much. Michael Meyer? I mean, there's so many intersecting threads here. I want to look more closely at some of them. Mm-hmm. But there's a Western architect busily at work, and there have been a lot of Western architects at work in remaking Beijing and saying, come on, you know, life was lousy. And of Li Hu saying earlier, these Hutong, the courtyard life, was built for a time pre-49 when maybe it was more privileged, affluent population that lived in much of it, and that when you had the People's Revolution and the sort of Dr. Zhivago-style scenes of, you know, masses of people pushing in here and taking over every little nook and cranny, the designed charm of these things turned into something quite different.
Mm-hmm, that's true. I mean, in the book, I talk about how whenever you're looking at a city, you're really just dipping your toe into a running river, and you're judging the current at that moment because every cities are always going through these cycles. In the book, I have four chapters that give the history of the destruction of Beijing because there's been, throughout its history, 800 years as a capital, Beijing has been destroyed, rebuilt, destroyed again. Even in the 1920s, Chinese and American architects were working in Beijing to pull down old gates, parts of the city wall. Pearl Buck even wrote a short story called The New Road about a development in China. So this has happened before. I mean, there's been an interplay between foreign and a push-pull between foreign and traditional influences in architecture on the city. What's indelible this time, though, what's really changing for good is that, like you said, these areas now in the center of town when they're being torn down because the land value is so high, that's being changed into commercial space. Or what you see in my neighborhood is they're tearing down authentic courtyard homes and rebuilding courtyard homes that retail for $1 million and up. But have modern conveniences. But you're absolutely right. In a way, old Beijing is reverting to its imperial form when the city center was reserved for the court and its acolytes, people of privilege.
And the new court, of course, the court of the School of Wealth. Let's get a call from Montreal, Canada, and Nadine. Hi, Nadine. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was in Beijing and in Shanghai a couple of years ago, and there was obviously a huge difference between both cities. Shanghai developed the way it did into even better than New York City, really.
The sort of very, very tall skyline of Shanghai, yeah, as opposed to the flatter, widespread face of Beijing.
Right, and then that happened on its own. And then here you have the Olympics coming and changing Beijing, mm-hmm, in a way that is really irreversible. It's like getting rid of Venice altogether. And I think that is really sad to think, because the Olympics usually show up in cities and they build stadiums, they clean up the streets. You know, the cities of all over the world have been better. In this particular case, though, the effects of the Olympics on Beijing has been actually the opposite, I find. And you can't go back and get the history and the character of a city ever again. Once you destroy something like Venice, you're going to be destroying something similar to Beijing, is what I see.
It's a very interesting point, Nadine. And I wonder what you make, mm-hmm, of it. This is a wholesale transformation of, mm-hmm, of a great and ancient city, not just an Olympic village. I mean, there is that. But, I mean, this, mm-hmm, is just sort of wall-to-wall transformation. How about the way the Olympics have been used and their impact? When people, mm-hmm, look back a century from now on what they meant for Beijing, what do you imagine they may say?
It's funny, isn't it? The word transformation, depending on the speaker, it has different meanings. Maybe the word transformation is destruction to some. Maybe it's modernization and construction to other ones.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. And I have to say, in defense here of the Olympic movement and its effect on Beijing, these changes were underway in Beijing starting in the 1990s, long before the Games were awarded in 2001. Now, having said that, though, the slogan for the winning bid was New Beijing, New Olympics. Mm. And, the professor that wrote that slogan said that by New Beijing, he meant a more cultured Beijing and a more technologically superior Beijing. And he said that city planners have taken that slogan and misinterpreted it. They think it means to tear down the old Beijing and build a new Beijing. But having said that, there aren't any venues that are inside the old city. So when you see this iconic architecture like the Bird's Nest and the Water Cube and these stadiums, those are being built in the northern suburbs or the eastern suburbs or western suburbs. We have the marathon course going through our neighborhood, and that's really that and a biking event are the only things in the old city. But it has certainly, the Olympics has attracted a ton of attention and investment. And again, Beijing is going through the cycle that every major world capital has gone through at some point. Here you just have this convergence of a property market for the first time in the People's Republic history, where you can buy housing outright. Mm-hmm. So you have that dovetailing with Beijing's emergence as a world capital and being an Olympic host. So it's really a perfect storm for transformation.
I wish you'd speak to the political motivations/implications of this transformation, this makeover. Back in 1989, Tiananmen Square days, and of course the protests and then the crackdown there. The Hutong you're talking about are very close to Tiananmen. I think people actually fled into those narrow streets to escape the tanks and soldiers and all the rest. And now you're talking about, super broad avenues, big setbacks. Among other things, it looks like a city easier to police. Is that paranoid to look at it that way?
No, I think that's true. And some people voice that opinion here. People in my neighborhood will say that it's erasing. Any city goes through this, but maybe in Beijing they're erasing places you can hide. The security cameras are around the city. That's changed a lot since I've been here. I was shocked on the last day of school last year to come into school and there was a security camera in my school. I thought, oh, that's a first, because the Hutong never has these cameras. But again, are we being paranoid by saying that's the reason, or is it for better policing? I mean, London has more security cameras per mile than any city in the world.
But politically, going forward, do you see a different profile emerging here? There's some you talk a lot about the loss of that dense weave, and of course, when people are less connected, they're going to produce a different kind of politics.
They do, and they cease having ownership over their community. And so, when I leave the Hutong, I find that I miss the civility that you find there, because your actions have repercussions. If you someone honks their horn at you, you're going to get called out because you know that person.
In the old neighborhood,
exactly. They keep their eyes on the street and whatnot. And it also, the hutong absorbs migrants, and they become the status quo. I mean, Gertrude Stein said the making of more Americans. I find the hutong to be the making of more Beijingers, because people from the countryside can come there. They can absorb easily into the workforce, get rent cheaply. It's not a slum. It's a stable, low-rent area.
And get mixed in close proximity and learn the local.
They learn Mandarin, then they in turn hire migrants from the countryside. And I'm amazed at how the most patriotic people I know in Beijing are migrants who came to the city and said, well, this economy and this structure right here is giving us a chance. And I worry when cities stop being able to absorb people from the countryside coming in or acculturating people, what their long-term effects of that is going to be.
Let's get a call from Royalton, Vermont, and Ellen. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is this. There's a lot of money, new money, in China. In the United States, some of the oldest neighborhoods were renovated essentially by yuppies. When poor people moved out, young, wealthier people moved in and preserved and enhanced the character of these neighborhoods with modern appliances. I wondered if that's possible in China. Your guest touched very briefly on this a few minutes ago, and I would like him to elaborate.
Sort of Beijing yuppies, or there are maybe not so rich but artistic cousins. How about it,
Michael? I'm thinking particularly of people who benefited from the boom in trade and business.
Michael? Oh, there's definitely a movement toward that. Thanks for calling, Ellen. I mean, you do see people with money now, like Li Hu was saying, wanting to move back into the city. It's really difficult with the hutong because Beijing's architecture is made from impermanent materials. We're talking about wood and brick. It's not like the great monuments of Europe made from stone, or even you can picture those houses in Venice that still survive centuries later. Beijing really, and it's a long-standing thing in Asian architecture, actually, when you do renovation, it often means pulling down the structure and building anew because the beams have been eaten by termites or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so that's very difficult in Beijing, that when people do want to renovate inside the city, what they're often doing now is tearing down the house's structure, or maybe keeping the frame of it, but they're building it as their own kind of, it's not a bad thing, it's just their own little pleasure palace, you know, with modern conveniences, maybe even a basement and whatnot. So if you're a strict preservationist or historian, you say this is a bad thing because Beijing's courtyard homes are volumes of the city's history. They're just written in brick and beam. But other people would say, well, no, look, this is actually a good thing because when you have people coming into the inner city and they're putting down money and they're renovating houses, that prevents that from becoming a McDonald's or a hotel or something like that. People will actually still live there, and that's a good thing.
Let's go to Quinn in Boston. Hi, Quinn. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just had a quick question regarding the concept of familyism compared to modernity in China. In the early 20th century and in the late 19th century, families in China depended so closely on each other in a way that I think Americans and other industrial societies didn't. And, you know, I guess my question is, in a modern China, does the concept of familyism and the importance of family transcend, or does individualism inherently take over? If you do not need help, for example, with a latrine or with carrying water miles, then it seems like the dependence on family is shrunk and the dependence on the individual rises. So if you could just talk a little bit about your experience with family and how it has transformed your modern day, if it has.
Great question, Quinn. Michael?
That's a great question, Quinn. Thank you. As far as the characters in the book go, I'm talking about the five or six people that have families that were moving out of these homes. They all stayed together. And even if they were buying a new apartment, let's say with their eviction settlement, I was surprised at how many times they would buy apartments next to one another so the parents could live right next door and help with the child, or they would buy something in a building nearby them so they would retain that structure. And I've also – that's a really good question. I haven't seen anyone leave the hutong and all of a sudden have no one there to help them anymore. You know, there's always been a granddaughter or a niece that has stuck around.
What about the sort of wonderful little traditions that people entertain themselves with in old Chinese neighborhoods? Do they go to the new high-rises? Do people still, you know, keep their little fighting crickets and feeding them honey and little tidbits? I was reading from Jasper Becker's City of Heavenly Tranquility. He talks about in Beijing when people would insert tiny carved flutes of bamboo into the tail feathers of pigeons, and then the whole flocks would sort of create aerial music over his courtyard house a decade ago. Will that kind of thing survive? Does it, Michael?
No, that doesn't. There's a character in the book who raises pigeons, which is a big hutong hobby, where he has a coop up on top of his roof. And yeah, he puts the whistle on their pinion feathers and they mourn sorrowfully overhead as they fly. But if you move to a new apartment, pigeons aren't allowed because they're messy or unsightly or whatnot. So that's something that dies. You know, the other thing I'm always struck at is how my students, because I taught grade 4, grade 5, grade 6, how when they were in the lanes, they were so looked after and protected. And even though they didn't have open space to play in, they were so loved and received so much attention and were always being told, you know, where to go next. And when I've seen them move to these new areas, they've lost that sort of nurturing atmosphere. So even though they have open space, they're not out there playing soccer by themselves. They're at home doing homework or watching television, unfortunately.
Well, it's a path many countries have been down, yes. Including not least our own. We'll watch with great interest as China moves on down that path. And Michael Meyer, we hope you'll keep an eye on it as well and come back and fill us in again on how this unbelievable evolution in China is unfolding as it does. Michael Meyer's new book is The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. He joined us from Beijing. Michael Meyer, wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks, Tom. I loved it.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, see a photo album of Hutong images at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Ping Huang, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. With help from Sam Gail Rose and Will Rose Lip and Samina Udine, our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.